Well, hello everyone. And of all the topics that come up, the one that Todd has chosen for today is one that I have struggled with a lot during my time in these sorts of spaces. I actually addressed it on my somewhat controversial series, Nima Parvini versus Right-Wing Ideas, which is now, well, about 6 months ago now, or however long ago it was, 4 or 5 months, where this topic came up again. And that is meritocracy. And it's one of the things that I've had. I mean, my buddy Mike from Imperium is against meritocracy. My buddy Pharaoh is against meritocracy. And time and again, I find myself, despite knowing all the things I do, finding its logic inescapable in a way. So I'm very interested to know what you have to say about it. If people are wondering, there is yet another cigar here. This is a Bolivar Petite Corona. And I am smoking it in solidarity with my comrades in Venezuela. Because Bolivar, if you know anything about him, was the original liberator of Venezuela. And I don't know if you've seen it, but Maduro has Bolivar's sword. Have you seen this? He actually has the original sword of Bolivar. And there are pictures of him like swinging it around, which I found greatly entertaining. So they're from Cuba, by the way, but they're called, the brand is Bolivar. Just before we get going, I have to mention my book, Foundations of Shakespeare, currently on pre-order. You can still get my other books, Applied Elite Theory, Prophets of Doom, Populist Illusion, and all the other ones. But this one, if you bought the course, the publishers have agreed to give 50% off the total price. You can get it on pre-order. And I currently have a sale on all of January called Shorjan promo code. I'm going to play the ad. And when we come back, Todd is going to defend meritocracy.
Sure. Yeah. Sure, 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 sure. And so, sure.
Sure, Jan.
Can you command a comma like Joseph Conrad?
Sure, sure, sure,
sure, sure, sure, and sure, Jan.
Are you magnificent in your mastery of marginalism like Murray Rothbard?
Sure,
sure, Jan.
Are you legendary in your logical leveling of lamentable loquacity?
Sure,
sure, Jan.
Come on down to the January sale at the Academic Agency. Promo code SHORJAN for 25% off. All this January, I got more courses than the Queen had horses.
Sure, Jan.
I got better rates than Andrew Tate's ad mates.
Sure, Jan.
I got better deals than Lizzo's had meals.
Sure.
Sure, Jan.
And so, sure, 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 and so, sure.
Tell you what, if you're not sick to death of that one, I don't know. I am. The thing is, though, what will happen is that because an entire year goes round, the level of exhaustion with it will dissipate into nostalgia. And this time, like in 12 months, people will be hankering back for Straw Jam. That's what happens in the life cycle of these ads. Now, meritocracy, Todd. One of the issues I've had is that as an avid video gamer, I've always had the issue, you know, there's this game Crusader Kings 2. And I always start in this little county in Wales, little earldom in Glamorgan. And the trouble is that I, as a gamer, I like to min-max stats. You have to min-max. And in the game Crusader Kings, you have a council, okay? And so there's a guy in charge of, managing the economy. There's a guy in charge of the military and so on. But the trouble is that because when you start the game, you're in this little place in Wales, the total pool of available talent is quite small. And so if I chose only from those people, I would have a subpar court, which then limits the amount of money I make, the amount of men I recruit, and so on and so forth. And so my courts in Crusader Kings 2, because I'm a power gamer, are a disgrace viewed from a certain point of view. For example, there's always a moment where a Jewish guy turns up and seeks to join the court. Typically, he's got high skills. Either he's a good chancellor or he's a good treasurer, right? And he's got like 20 in that stat. I take him and stick him on the court. Or I don't know. And there's some Polish lord who's been exiled from Eastern Europe. Okay, his family want to kill him or whatever, but he's got pretty good martial stats. All right, I'll stick him in. Okay, I'm not a purist when it comes to these things. I could have the all Welsh court, but that would mean losing out on revenue, losing out on men. So my courts in Crusader Kings end up becoming very multicultural because I'm choosing these men on stats because I want the stats. Similar logic applies in many other fields. Football is an example I've used in the past. If the football club who refused to pick Africans, okay, as a policy, then you'd be losing out on certain footballers who have high stats in acceleration, pace, stamina, and so on and so forth. And you see this logic play out in the world of sports quite often. You know, NFL teams are something like 80% black. If you have a look at the Olympics, Olympic sprinting teams, right, they tend to be from a certain background. Jamaica seems to dominate in that field. If I wanted to be a purist and not pick on merit, you know, you'd be rejecting the Jamaican runner. And so one of the problems I have is I understand the arguments against all these things and where they lead to. But the pure logic of the min-max, Todd, the pure logic of you need the best guy. I can't look at, like, what, I'm going to not pick Thierry Henry for Arsenal because he was a black French guy? I have to pick him. Gives me an edge. You see what I'm saying? And this is the basic problem I have with anti-meritocratic arguments. Then the flip side, of course, is... you know, you look at very deeply ethnocentric groups and who use nepotism as a strategy, and then you see a massive degeneration in talents for them, which gets them into trouble. Anyway, I've said my bit. What do you say, Todd?
Right. So I've also been a defender of meritocracy, because the first thing you have to say is if you don't hire somebody according to merit, what do you hire? What are you hiring for? Well, what you're really saying is you're hiring for incompetence, because the person, if you're not looking for the quality guy to get the job done, then you're looking for something other than quality, which, okay, well, that means you're not hiring for that. Now, usually it's loyalty. You mentioned nepotism, but let's sort of look at the origins of modern meritocratic thinking. It begins in the military. And it begins in the bourgeois revolution against the aristocratic powers and monarchies of Europe. So we first see this with the English Civil War, and then we see it with the French Revolution. And while this isn't really a nationalist project, we also see this in the Bolshevik Revolution. Officers in these armies were a class appointments, right? They knew the king, they were related to the king. Perfect example would be Prince Rupert of the Rhine, who leads royalist forces in the English Civil War. And he just utterly bungles everything up for the king. The king arguably lost the war because he gave his relative such an important position in the royalist military. And he didn't have to be good at the job. He was the king's relative. He's in, right? So, and there's no like sense of, okay, we have to test your performance. You know, come back for a review in 5 to 6 months. Now, originally, Parliament's army was a lot like that too. But then Cromwell reforms it. And then you have this well-oiled machine where the people who become leaders are those who actually perform well under fire. They're not political appointees. And that's one of the things that a lot of the royalists were confused about. How are we getting beaten by, you know, printers and blacksmiths and all of these tradesmen? Well, because they were put under pressure, they were tested, and they were found to be able to bear the heat, right? Same goes in France. Royalist armies are led by appointees, you know, these. Now, on the one hand, you might say, well, there are no military academies at the time, so any sort of military training in a professional sense would have been given to the upper classes. just as a matter of default. But the issue then becomes, we know that they're not competent. They disobey orders. They don't take proper precautions. They don't follow proper military procedure because they don't have to. They don't have to. Their job's not really on the line if they don't. Now, I guess they could lose a battle and die. But they got used to winning because they either fought each other in the Middle Ages and Renaissance, or they fought peasants who had no military training whatsoever. But once you have a political system that's willing to select officers based on merit, now in this case, it'd be from experience. There were no officer schools yet, right? So by the Russian Revolution, there was, but prior to that, there wasn't. And so this would have just been on the ground experience, right? And then you get to the top and we see the results. Parliament beats the royalists, the French revolutionaries. And then of course, Napoleon, he builds on this precedent and just topples, you know, all these European monarchies who they're forced to make compromises and concessions to that principle. Because if they're going to be Napoleon, they've got to start utilizing some of those strategies as well. And so you then couple this with a certain socialist reading that the reason why the lower classes, who are considered illegitimate for these leadership positions, is because they weren't educated, right? They weren't given access to that education that could have allowed them to be ministers in parliament or military officials. And so let's look at the United States versus Europe. I mean, one of the things that the United States does is it defines itself against entrenched class privilege. Now, it's since reasserted itself in the shadows via the oligarchy, but that's a separate issue. The original principle was that we're not going to have this stratified class system like England. And that gave America a level of dynamism that England lacks even today, because even in its decayed state, the American spirit still has that as an ideal. We expect it, even if we don't always get it. And we want it in a way that other countries don't pressure their political leadership class to give them that, right? And so why do I start with this? Well, because war is the highest court of appeals. You win or you die. Okay, so any of these little mental games you want to play about, you know, meritocracy, if you're going to have some guy marching shoulder to shoulder with you on the battlefield, and then you're going to have to serve under this guy or under a general's authority, you want him to be good. Otherwise, you're going to die.
Yeah, I mean, while we're having this, I can imagine a lot of viewers are screaming at the screen. Some of them will be screaming just for me to play this clip. Hold on.
Merit, pure merit, such merit, merit, such merit, merit.
Right. So some people will want me to play that, but it does. How can I say? Like Jordan Peterson, I am sure, a staunch defender of meritocracy. But I can bet you anything, Todd, that he hasn't got a problem with Barry Weiss being appointed the editor of CBS. Right?
Yeah.
He doesn't have a problem with Larry Ellison just being gifted TikTok, right? Or, I don't know, these talks of Paramount Pictures being bought by... And he would defend those things that I would see as ruthless in-group preference and ethno-narcissism. He would defend those as being actually the result of merit, okay? So this is one problem, because people have a look at the current system and they can see that it is not meritocratic, and yet the people who defend the system argue that the people like the Barry Weisses, who clearly, I mean, if there's ever an example of nepotism in action, it's the appointment of Barry Weiss to that role, okay? Like, they see that as a con. They see that as they're being lied to. And so they say, well, actually, they reject the concept altogether. They say, well, actually, it's obviously not meritocracy. It's who you know. This is the way that the system works. And if you hold on to individual meritocracy, they will say, against this, then nepotism is going to win out. Because if every other group, this group, the Barry Weiss group, or Indians is another example. I mean, I remember, do you remember when Vivek Ramaswamy went on his massive rant about how Indian families work harder and they're there through merit, and that, you know, Americans need to get back and work hard. He was given hell. And a lot of people were like, actually, Vivek Ramaswamy, you're not there because of merit at all. You're a scam artist and a con man and a beneficiary of DEI. What's your comeback to all of these sorts of arguments that people have against that people bring whenever I say, well, actually, meritocracy has a difficult logic to escape? They'll say, well, if you have a look at the past 100 years, it's been nepotism that's won out, in-group preference that wins out, and meritocracy loses.
So I would say that what a lot of this amounts to is, for those who have read C.S. Lewis's The Last Battle, the dwarves. So the basic premise, spoiler alert, is that there's a fake Aslan who's being manipulated by shadowy forces in order to get the Narnians to do what they want. Okay, no, but it's not real Aslan, it's the fake one that they're controlling. And when the real Aslan shows up, the dwarves are like, well, look, you guys are just as fake as the other guys. So we're going to have no Aslan at all. We don't believe in any, because, and that's really what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with the dwarves from the last battle. They've been had once, and they're not going to be had again. That's the psychological reality that's going on here. And then, so the other thing then is, okay, I would ask, what would it take to demonstrate that this thing over here we call merit-based is authentic versus this thing over here, which is a farce? And I think there's a pretty easy test. You know, if you were handed everything on a silver platter with a silver spoon in your mouth, that's not merit. Okay, you can call it whatever you want to call it. That's not getting there because of merit. That's getting there by accident of birth. Whereas if, the boomers have done this to death, but the idea of, like, you know, growing up in a poor community, going to school, getting your degree, then becoming successful. That is how Europe got into the industrial age. You had these large scale education systems, usually from the state, that then educated its own population rather than making it just a purview of the court, the monarchy, right? And then they got in. And, you know, if you studied hard, you got ahead. Now, of course, are you going to eliminate politics completely? No, but that's not really the point. The point is, are we going to have people who are in positions of influence who are actually good at what they do? Because here's the irony of all of this, right? Let's go back to 2010, right? What was the line in 2010 on the online right? That this actually goes to, I think it was Spandrel, the idea that when it comes to managing techno capital, white guys are the best. And that the reason why we are being, it's unjust that we're being discriminated against, why we should be the ones in charge, is because we are the ones who are best able to keep techno capital going. These other groups, you know, his Bioleninist argument, they don't work. They don't work in techno capital. We do. We make it run. That was a meritocratic argument, and everybody bought that line. Now, all of a sudden, we're going to pivot, you know, 10 years later and say, well, meritocracy is bad. Well, which is it? Are you being suppressed by the dark elf liberals because you're so good at running techno capital as a white guy? Or, you know, and it's your right, you've earned it, you've done the work, it's merit-based. Or are you going to say, we're just going to throw out merit entirely? Because if you do, that argument falls apart. You can't appeal to it anymore.
I mean, another argument that does that is a variation on this is the notion that 130 plus IQ white guys, you know, invented the modern world under the British Empire. They didn't need to do all this meritocratic hiring back then. They managed to produce Darwin and all these other great people in history, Brunel, whoever, you name it. And ultimately, because 130 IQ white guys did all of this, then in any truly merit-based system, they'll be the ones who win out ultimately, because all the other groups are bad. The trouble with that, Todd, is that I wonder about the truth of these claims. It is true that you know, the British Empire achieved a great deal and invented tons of things and brought us modernity and all the rest of it. And Americans play their part, and all the other European nations play their part. But I wonder if, I mean, just by the same logic of what you talked about, okay, the working classes at a certain point were being locked out. They weren't being absorbed into the talent pool. The talent pool was then expanded to include working class who could then work themselves up or become a tycoon and, you know, scrape their way out of poverty that way type thing. Now, that talent pool has been expanded to include pretty much everybody in the entire world, okay? And one of the things I worry about is that this argument that as it is currently applied may not be true. And the example I went to, and I, again, I was called everything for this, but I'm just telling the truth. When I worked in the city and I was meeting, you know, high tech trading people and, you know, quant, what do you call them, market making firms, I noticed that the entire quant teams were Chinese. All of them were. Presumably that's because only they have the mathematical ability, or they have the, you know, they can make those systems work. It's just so noticeable. And it was because I was putting on the events, it was a bit of an issue because they were like, oh, you need to get a quant to talk. I get a quant up there and he was Chinese, couldn't speak a bloody word of English, which doesn't make for a good event, is what I mean, right? So, like, if you go, but then the argument would be if you go down this route of accepting it, then you end up with a multicultural, then you end up with the, you know, the rainbow, it's like your team ends up like a Gap advert or something, United Colors of Benetton. You know, you got a black guy and a Chinese guy and an Indian guy now. And I mean, I know lots of people will anecdotally say, well, yeah, the truth is, though, these Indian guys you have, they're not very good. They've been hired on the cheap or whatever. But what I wonder about, looking at just at the raw fact, is that with so many millions, billions of people involved in the talent pool, reality is that some of those Indian guys are going to be good. Some of the Chinese guys are going to be good. So, like, with that being the case, can you then fall back on this notion that, oh, well, actually, it's just like the superior Anglo will ultimately make things work? Or is it a cope? Is what I'm saying. You understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would argue if you look at empires that, you know, become multicultural, you end up having a slide into patronage and, like you said, favoritism, because you have so many people to deal with, you need to artificially simplify the relations. And so the easiest way to artificially simplify the relations is loyalty to the imperial system. And so you have, you ultimately have a crystallization where maybe we could call this a reverse bio-Leninist effect, where everybody becomes homogenous because it's just easier to deal with this kind of quote diversity. And I'll give you a concrete example. Again, war. The Persians invade Greece. They have all these different people with all these different languages. That makes communications a complete nightmare, right? The Greeks don't have that problem. They all speak the same language, even though they come from different city states. So you have a communications issue that the Persians can't really deal with. There are added costs by expanding the scope of the merit pool to these other groups, one of which is communications. The cost goes way up.
Go ahead. Isn't that meritocracy, though? Ultimately, isn't that where merit, that the argument is, the pushback would be, isn't that where meritocracy leads? Because you keep on expanding. Like, I always remember Boris Johnson when he was the prime minister. He said something like, I believe that talent is distributed equally among the population at large, like the British population at large. And that we as the government just need to unlock it. Okay. But clearly Boris Johnson doesn't just believe that of like the British population, white British population. He believes it of all people. That's why he did the body. Like, that's why he brought in all these different people. Because in his heart of hearts, he believes in this vision that talent is distributed out there. Okay. And it's just up to modern governments to kind of do a seek and pluck out that person who's talented. The thing is, though, is that surely the law of averages is that you are going to like cast the net wide enough and you are going to find, I don't know, some dude from Kazakhstan or something who's actually pretty good. You know what I mean? Like it is, but then it leads to this. And this is where people have the problem with meritocracy, because I guess the counter would be like, you don't need all these other people. There's talent enough just in this one group, just in British people. They've shown it in the past. So what do you need the Indian dude for? What do you need the bloke from Kazakhstan for, etc.? How do you deal with that in your defense of meritocracy? Yeah.
So the first thing is you mentioned assumptions about the labor pool, right? So the idea is that for those who are in favor of the modern neoliberal globalist meritocracy, the idea is that talent is equally, humans are fungible. Everything is, you know, interchangeable, like a cog in the machine. So therefore, every population group is going to have roughly similar probabilities for all these things.
Yeah.
I would reject that assumption. Now, that doesn't necessarily make me an ethno-nationalist, but I would reject that assumption. And I would argue that, in fact, it's actually probably not the case that it's equally distributed across. But then furthermore, we need to talk about the cost of a thing. So in economics is the law of diminishing returns. So no matter what you do, right, no matter what you do, you're going to reach a peak where you have maximum value. And if you keep putting energy into it, you're going to lose value. And that's the same for everything. So I would argue on the one level that, yeah, there's a point at which you have. So let's go back to Crusader Kings too, right? At least in more recent iterations of the game, you can't pull, let's say you're in Wales, you can't really pull somebody from India because there's a geographic boundary. If you go searching for council members with certain traits or qualities, you have a little globe show up on the bottom, I think, right corner of their icon saying they're too far away. That's a cost. That's true. That's an energy cost. So that's the way the game represents it that way, right? You can't go from like Wales to England and back and forth. But that's a cost. And then furthermore, if we look at like, say, Athens in its golden age or England under the Elizabethan period, that level of like creative, explosive dynamism is not really found in these polyglot civilizations. There's mm-hmm. something going on that is not present in, say, like the Persian Empire, but is present in Athens. That's something that is present in Tudor England, but not the Spanish Empire. And I think part of it is that merit is, it is true that you want people that are good at their job, but you also mm-hmm. want people that you can communicate with effectively. And so the more barriers to communication that you bring in, that's a separate independent variable that undercuts merit because they might be really good, but if they don't, if you can't communicate with them, if you can't trust them, that doesn't work. And so the overall net effect is that you have a decrease in efficiency, right? The decrease in efficiency due to these other social factors that are compounding. Now, you know, I would argue this is just what happens with the law of diminishing returns on any sort of human endeavor. And with regards to the United States, I think what meritocracy was supposed to be a vehicle for, since been derailed and hijacked by the oligarchy, was the natural aristocracy. So I would agree with like Jefferson and Calhoun and other early founders that this would also align with, you know, elite theory. That there are these natural elites. And that meritocracy in the 18th century, both on both sides of the pond, was like, look, the current establishment in Europe is a bunch of, you know, dinosaurs. They're calcified. They don't allow circulation of elites. They don't allow new people to come in. But we know they're out there. So the United States, the principle was, we're going to create a system, a republic, where we create a mechanism based on merit to allow for a natural circulation of elites to have the natural aristocracy rise to the fore to constantly resupply the leadership. Because you run the risk of having, you know, the European hairy child, you know, the heir to the throne is a hairy kid, right? Because you've closed off your bloodlines, you've closed off the circulation of elites. What I would say is the way I see meritocracy working historically as it was meant to, is a way to create a vehicle for the natural aristocracy that is latent outside of the palace or outside of the Capitol building to have a chance to get in by doing performance. Sort of what China did with the Confucian bureaucratic tests in the imperial period.
Yeah, there's an issue here, Todd. I'm going to try to put my finger on it. You said earlier on that the problem with the working classes and the peasants and so on, they just hadn't been given the opportunity. They hadn't been given the education, okay? But why wouldn't you, I mean, if you were a consistent leftist, let's say, if I was a leftist on this stream, more left than me as a sensible center leftist, obviously. You know what I'm saying, right? If there was a doctrinaire leftist here, they'd be saying like, yeah, but surely that just applies to all people everywhere. This also applies to an Indian kid. And there have been tons of examples, let's say, of Indians who were born in this country, who then go to the best schools, who then end up, you know, the Rishi Sunak, the Priti Patel, the, you know, you can pick any example you can think of, you know, if they're socialized in the right way, what's stopping those people also having the same talents? They've been given the same education and they, you know, okay, they've got brown skin, but they end up doing the same function in some cases as well as or better than the native. So where does it, I mean, I'm guessing what I'm saying is, where do you stop this? Because the logic of meritocracy is want to keep on expanding that talent pool. And it'd be like, right, okay, there may be a lot of dross there, but there's that one gem, the chess champion living in the slum in Delhi or something. He's there. We're going to find him. Or like I started in the start, you know, the Thierry Henry, French African or whatever. But the fact that he's a fantastic footballer, we found him. How can you artificially lock him out? So I guess where I struggle with this is that I see the logic of meritocracy, but it's a runaway train. It doesn't stop. And, it, you know, okay, you can say, well, America is a country founded on this principle, but America also then is the country founded on unlimited immigration. It doesn't, and in the end, it doesn't matter if you're an Anglo or an Italian or a Mexican or whoever, you can make it in the land of the free. This is like what America's always said, but it has no limiting principle because merit doesn't, like, at the end of the day, it won't respect all of these other things that people care about if what you're looking for is the stat, is the person who's good at the job. And this is where people struggle with it. And also where I struggle, I don't know what the answer is. So how do you stop it? How do you stop the kid? Why do you say to the kid, Vivek Ramaswamy's son, say, I don't know if he's got a son, let's just pretend. Look, you've been to the best schools. You've shown you can do it. You've got talent. But I say you're not allowed that chance because these chances are only for these people over here. You're just then recreating the old aristocratic problem, aren't you? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, so a couple few things here. The first thing I'd say is I just don't agree with the fact that since the 60s, well, and of course that's when it began, but it really starts to accelerate in the 90s, this demographic displacement based on the justification of meritocracy actually holds any water. What I see this is actually happening is, you know, the oligarchy doing what the oligarchy does. It wants immigrants to reduce the cost of labor. Okay. Yeah. How do you do that? How do you sell that to Americans? How do you sell to Americans that we're going to reduce the cost of labor without actually saying it? Well, you appeal to any number of stock American ideas, including, but not limited to, meritocracy. Now, we can look at the measurable effects of this. If we were to look at the revolution in aerospace technology from, say, the 1930s and right up until the 80s, so you have, you know, you've got the Skunk Works team, Lockheed Martin, you've got aerospace, you've got NASA, then you've got the stealth aircraft in the 80s, you've got the F-16 fighter with the Greg Boyd revolution. All of this was basically a cadre of mostly white, probably some Jewish, American engineers, all male. That 50-year window of aerospace development was absolutely unparalleled in history. Now let's look at the aerospace system since then. Completely stagnated. Completely stagnated. These people weren't, they were clearly not being hired based on their merit, because we can measure the difference in the result. There has been no innovation in aerospace equivalent to what we saw in that golden age of 50 years. Why? Well, there's a lot of reasons why, but one of the reasons is these people are not as good as the ones that they replaced. Because if they were, we would see and be able to measure an equivalent product, which we don't. And that was actually, I think, Spandrel's argument, in which case I 100% agree. There was a key difference in the human capital that was being used to build the foundations of U.S. aerospace. And we just don't see it today because it's been diluted with all these elements. What they were doing, were bringing these people in because they were easy to control. They come from authoritarian backgrounds, Latin America, the Middle East. A lot of these countries don't have democratic or republican principles. So they're used to the hierarchical top-down pressure from, you know, Jefe, right? But this time Jefe is the CEO in a suit. He's a dark elf, right? So instead of your local Mexican drug dealer, you know, he's a dark elf in a suit. The point is, though, this guy is not going to go on strike. This guy isn't going to push for better wages. This guy isn't going to be a pain in the neck in a way that, you know, heritage Americans might be. And so I would argue that just from the tangible and measurable effects of U.S. aerospace, for example, or any other aspect of American industry or military power. For example, the United States military hasn't really won a war since it integrated the military in Korea. Isn't that interesting? Very interesting. So there's that element. And then furthermore, with the idea of merit, I think also what constitutes merit is really important here, right? Because we live in a post-metaphysical age. We live in a post-Christian age. We're struggling to identify what terms mean, right? Historically, merit was a moral term. And a good example would be in Catholic theology, the treasury of merit, the meritorious good works that Christ and the saints have that the Catholic, through prayer, can access. So merit is fundamentally a moral quality, which does have a practical effect, but that's not how it's treated today. But throughout history, let's look at the Romans. One of the key to Roman statecraft was merit. They hired based on merit. And if you didn't live up to that standard, then you would not be hired or included. So, you know, with the performance of all these new, quote, fresh blood, you know, women in the workforce, all these immigrants from non-European countries, the results are just not the same. Just not at all. Look at U.S. aerospace from the 30s to the 80s and look at it now. And the difference is back then these were not like blue bloods. These were guys that went to college and university and got engineering degrees, but they were all heritage Americans. And so, you know, their performance just blows everything out of the water with what has come since.
One of the things that Vivek Ramaswamy said, and this is something, I mean, as somebody who's worked in higher education and as somebody who was a kind of a star student in my kind of, you know, when I was an undergraduate and so on. But Vivek Ramaswamy talked about, and he was barracked for this, I remember it, but he said, like, look, when you come from the sort of family I did, like, when all the other kids are out partying, his kids are, or he was, swatting up, doing the extra bit of work, working really hard. Okay. I've marked hundreds, thousands of papers in my time. And I noticed that, you know, in a university setting, there were a lot of very diligent students, often female, it has to be said, right? Who worked, who went the extra mile, revised, you know, gave you the answer you wanted a lot of the time, okay? And this is a very hard thing to put your finger on. And whenever I've tried to talk about it in any sort of setting, it's kind of like not very PC to talk like this. I was never a student like that, okay? I was not worky. I've never been worky in that sense. I do work, right? But in a different set, like I was always a kind of how can I say? I just relied on flair, you know, I guess. I didn't need to work that hard to produce good results because I was an ideas guy. I had the idea that nobody else would come to, you know, that they'd give the question and I'd be able to challenge it in some way. This was just a different way of being. Okay. This is a different type of top student to the sort of student that Vivek Ramaswamy was talking about. Okay. But how can I put this? There is a truth to the fact that that diligent student, the one, okay, they may not have top flair. They may not be able to come up with the outside of the box take that I was able to do, right? But they're consistent. They put the hours in, and they do also end up also getting that first or getting the 10 A's at GCSE and the 4 A's at A level. They still get the results. They can show it on paper. And because they've got that diligent quality, there is a certain merit to it. So what do you say? Because the thing is how can I put this? As somebody who's had to think seriously about education, one of the first things I had to learn was like, well, you can teach someone hard work, good habits, diligence. You can't necessarily give them like creative spark or something like that, right? And in a way, like, so, but what I'm trying to come out with here is that there is something to what Vivek was saying, right? You can't have a workforce or a team only of kind of mavericks or people who, you know, you understand what I'm saying? You have to also have those people who are going to put the work in. And the question would be, rightly, I'd say, in defense of Vivek and various other people I've known like this, they've put the work in and you haven't. They've got the result and you haven't. So in that scenario, how can you say that their merit is not earned? You see what I'm saying? Like in just a basic fairness. Does that make any sense? Have I made any sense to you here, Tom?
I mean, I know the sort of line you're going with here. What I would say is that you said something very important, which was they can show you what they did. But you see, here's the thing, right? Most of society has been structured so that most people who do work hard and grind don't get seen. You have to be in the right place at the right time to have the spotlight on you. And you have to have receipts that people are willing to actually acknowledge your receipts. In most cases, that's not how it works. Now coming from a position of privilege and background like Vivek, it's a lot easier to get people to admit that you have these receipts, and it's more easy to show them to other people. But you know, if you're not from that background, you're gonna have a very much harder time convincing people that you have those receipts. See, what you used to be able to do, you can't do this anymore, but it was a theme in American cinema and literature and even in American life. You just had to be good enough to get the job done. Okay, so we're going to go back to the military here. You could be a total maverick like Stonewall Jackson, Confederacy. You could be Lawrence of Arabia, the British Empire, or Ord Wingate, or cantankerous like Patton. But you delivered. You got the job done. And so you might not be on the Joint Chiefs of Staff. You know, you might not be the face of the U.S. Army in Europe like Eisenhower, but you have a pretty good position. You're well-established, and you get the job done. You can't do that now. And the turning point was when MacArthur got fired by Truman. And he said, he prophesied that America would never win wars again because he said there's no substitute for victory. And the problem here is you can't do that anymore. That's what a real meritocratic system would mean. You could come out from the outside. You could suck eggs like Stonewall Jackson. And as long as you were a genius, as long as you could actually do the thing, you'd be in. Now it's not about doing the thing. It is about... Okay, Machiavelli said it's better to appear to be good than to be good. In the modern bureaucratic state, it's better to appear accomplished than to be accomplished. As long as you do the paperwork right. So, for example, the recent cancellation of the Constellation frigate, one of the reasons why it got so far off track was because people were playing the paperwork game. Nobody was actually bothering to go to the dock to see how the production was going because all the paperwork matched up. Until people went to the docks and said, wow, we've got to cancel this program. We can't even run this anymore. Mm-hmm. So part of it is there's like an inside track of perception that people like Vivek, who do have class access, just get automatically. And then furthermore, they then shut the door to anybody like Patton or MacArthur, or MacArthur actually was a blue blood, but like Patton or Jackson or Ord Wingate getting ahead. And so you just can't do that anymore, because ultimately we're not really interested in results. What we're interested in is maintaining the status quo.
Right. And those diligent types rather than the mavericks will be preferred in such a system. Yeah. Yeah, I get that. Mavericks end up getting fired a lot of the time.
They do. But back in the day, they were indispensable. So for example, NASA in its early days had an engineer who was a member of Thelema, the occult group with Aleister Crowley. I mean, they didn't care what his background was. They just wanted the guy to put a rocket into space.
Right. But I'm just trying to be devil's advocate again, because we're going to call this video In Defense of Meritocracy. Is there not something to say for the guy who works hard, though? Right, because I've seen it with my own eyes what we're talking about is there's a difference between ability, raw talent and ability, where the guy doesn't have to work that hard, okay, and somebody who's a grafter who will still get the job done and still deliver a decent result. It may not be buzzing with the creative ideas and so on, but they're still actually delivering the result just through a different method. And what Vivek was trying to do in that notorious spiel was defend the grafter, defend the person who gets there through sheer hard work, not going to the parties, being the nerd and all that sort of stuff. Is there not something to, like, if we're going to defend meritocracy, is that not part of meritocracy as well?
Well, let me put it this way. There is the distinction between what we would call talent and then effort. Right. So one sense, you could have a guy that is just very talented, doesn't have to work that hard. You have a guy that is not as talented, has to work a lot harder. And so diligence and hard work, of course, ought to be rewarded, but that isn't the same as talent. And even in a system that recognizes merit, the way I would see it unfolding is a complete loafer would be at the bottom because he's not doing anything. This guy would be above the loafer, so the Sigma guy that just grinds it out. And then the actual genius, the actual talented one, should be the one at the top. And again, this was the American model. This is what the natural aristocracy that Jefferson and Calhoun talked about was. They didn't believe that there'd be a homogenous, classless society. They did, but the problem was they saw that in England, the natural talents of English-speaking peoples were being suppressed by the monarchy. And so they're like, well, no, we need to give them the tools to get out. And of course, merit just means, let's go back to Aristotle, giving someone what they deserve. So if you work hard and you grind it out, then yeah, you do deserve something. But what you don't deserve, you know, if you're not Patton, you don't deserve to lead the Third Army. Sorry, you just don't. But you might be, you know, an NCO or an officer, but you're not going to be Patton.
Right. So, I mean, I guess what you're saying is, or what we're coming to the conclusion, I mean, I think Ed Dutton has talked about this in the past as well, is that the current system is select for conformity. And if you're those people, the mavericks, I guess we've been calling them, right, the patterns of this world, are selected out, or they're not, or they're pathologized even, you know, with the DSM, like they say, well, you're neurodiverse. That's the language they use now. You're neurodiverse, so you don't fit this model, and therefore they're selected out. Whereas, I don't know, in the late 19th century or whatever, these would have been the people who were innovating, but they're not allowed to now. Something like this. Is this getting towards it? Okay.
Yeah, exactly. And so the kind of idea here is, this is often an unstated premise. So in philosophy, a lot of times when we talk about arguments between people, a lot of it's rooted in undeclared assumptions. Mm-hmm. And so the word merit has a positive moral connotation to it. So everybody uses that term, but they don't always explain what they mean by it. So if you look at America before and after, let's say Korea, because I draw Korea as the dividing line because they fire MacArthur. It's before Korea, America wants to get things done. They want to build things. They want to put things into space or build, you know, win wars and whatnot, right? And then selection is for highly talented people that may even be antisocial. And after all, Patton was antisocial. The thing is, though, he got the job done. And there's kind of an inertia that chugs along. You got the aerospace guys we talked about. But then by the 90s, it's they've roped it all in. It's conformity. Because we've already built it, right? The mindset of the elite is we've already built this thing. Now, we don't need the Mavericks and the crazy guys to do this. No, but there's, of course, one thing that they forgot. They forgot MacArthur's prophecy. They're not going to win wars anymore. Because you can play this game where merit doesn't matter if it's purely social and the people in charge are manipulating the game. But if we view war as the highest level of competition, only God is controlling the meta. So in that regard, if you start playing this game long enough, you're just going to keep losing. And well, what do you know? The U.S. has been losing on a losing streak ever since Korea. Why? Because it doesn't pick people based on talent. It doesn't want to win anymore. And that's what MacArthur's complaint was. He's like, I'm not allowed to win this war. Why am I even fighting it? It's actually a very good question. You could ask a lot of the guys in the GWAT too, right? Why are you fighting this war if you're not allowed to win it? And so what I think we're seeing now, and we'll see more of it, is as unlike, say, China, which does, you know, appoint people within its, you know, I grew up thinking, the communists don't pick people based on their merit, right? But we've lived through so much wokeism and political correctness in the West that, you know, I'm kind of disabused that the West is just uniquely special, at least now, in hiring for talent, because it clearly doesn't. And you could say that, you know, okay, China has political party, communist party with ideology. Okay, but we do too. But China can still build railroads. China can still build ships. The United States can't do that anymore.
But Todd, I mean, there's two things I want to come back on here. And again, I don't have the answer because this is one of those issues I've never been able to get to the bottom of. You say, well, okay, the thing is, though, the Chinese, and again, we're stereotyping, we're dealing in generalities, but I mean, the Chinese don't really select for the Maverick either, do they? They're a pretty conformist society. They don't excel in creative talents historically. Mao's wife, coming back to the last video, was a bit of a Maverick, I guess you'd say. But, you know, typically they tend to select for the grafter rather than the creative or the Maverick. So that's one thing I would query. Another thing I would query is that, you know, if we go back to World War II, the Germans, as a doctrine, did actually support their Mavericks. They did give great autonomy to various generals and commanders on the battlefield, as against the Soviets, who you'd imagine were a lot more conformist, a lot more, you know, routinely purged their high command and so on for, you know, ideological purity, and yet the Russians won. So, I mean, I'm just trying to think of things that people would say here, and those would be two. Like, how do you deal with this?
So let's start with China. I would broadly agree that China is a more of a conformist civilization. Now, using my meritocratic angle here, up until the revolution of 1911, which overthrew the Qing dynasty, China was routinely subjugated and conquered by nomadic steppe peoples who were meritocratic. You didn't rise to become great Khan or head of Tumen by, you know, graft. You had to actually prove yourself. And so, you know, over the 2,000-year struggle between China and the nomads won. They conquered China with the Manchus in 1644, and then they ruled for almost 300 years. So China has a lot of human potential and resources, but Genghis Khan had Mongolia in the 13th century had about 1 million people. China at that time had about 70. and somehow Mongolia conquers China. That's merit. That's the difference there, merit. The Mongolian army was just better than everyone else. And the Chinese were met. This wasn't even a technological advantage like the West had with guns and battleships. This was just pure merit. And then, of course, the West had the China had the center of humiliation. No, they were still ruled by the Manchus, but the West also, under Britain and France, had embraced this maverick creative energy. So, yeah, they have a lot of potential, but there's a limiting factor. And I would argue that is one of their limiting factors. And then if we look at World War II with Germany and the Soviet Union, the limiting factor there was, well, a couple things. One is the entire Allied war effort in Europe at the time, their Soviet industrial military base was built by the United States. We've done videos on this before. And I would argue that, in a sense, look, Sparta at Thermopylae, right? You throw enough mud at the wall, you will take out the elite, you know, Chad, the Spartan warrior, but at a great cost. And the argument then would be that the leeway, though, the Nazi generals had were severely curtailed after 1942. Hitler had a lot of stand-in-place orders that let men get encircled, which went against the best advice of the generals. So I would say for the first 2 to 3 years of the war, you're right. They had a lot of leeway. They could make a lot of independent decisions. But from like 1942 on, the German generals are put on a much shorter leash. And many have argued that's in part why they lost on the Eastern Front. Because what was intended was an elastic defense where the Germans would have pre-assigned positions to fall back to. And then like a rubber band just go back and forth. Whereas Hitler mm-hmm. said, no, stand and defend. You know, like in Ukraine with like today, stand and defend, hold this city till the very last, which played to the Soviet strengths rather than the German strengths.
So it comes down to Hitler interfering, essentially.
Yeah, he sort of didn't understand the genius of the German system and worked against it.
My understanding as well on the Soviet side from my reading on this, which is limited, but probably more than the average person, I'd say, at this point, is that Stalin did the reverse. He started out interfering a lot and learned over the course of the war, actually, I don't know what the fuck I'm doing, and I better listen to Zhukov and friends or whatever, you know. So, i.e., the autonomy of the generals increased over the war once, I mean, there were several purges as well, but once the right generals were in place, Stalin actually took a step back. And after the war, he actually said that he regretted, or is it the Generalissimo or something? He took some title and he regretted that and said he should have left it to the generals. He openly admitted it. So you could argue that, oh, you know, what, now we've got into World War II, the comments are just going to be flooded with, the history nerd stuff. But I think that's generally not that controversial to say that, you know, by 1945, Stalin had learned to let the military guys do what they were going to do, and that he actually didn't know best when it came to this. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's pretty fair, and that's the position I've had. It reversed. So Hitler comes in, the Germans have, you know, wide latitude to make decisions, but then Stalin is the one saying stand and don't retreat. Then it flips. Yeah, that's I think a huge reason why Eastern Front turned out the way it did.
So if that's the case, how come militaries have not how come they've gone the route of purging their mavericks? You know, I mean, I watch Colonel Douglas McGregor a lot, right? And this is some of the sort of stuff that he would say. He finds himself on the outside. He's clearly not in power. And guys like him find themselves outside, critiquing. They're not the company men. So if it is the case that, you know, merit, like reality is the ultimate test of merit, why have armies gone in this, like, why haven't they learned this lesson, in your view?
Well, in large part because we shelter ourselves from reality, right? So with technology, we're able to indulge in moral hazards because we shield ourselves from the consequences of reality. Now, with the United States losing both in Vietnam and Afghanistan, what that tells us is the United States is so fantastically wealthy that it can afford to be wasteful like this. This is sort of the Russian problem, right? Russia under the Czars, under the Soviet Union, had great material resources and their human resources. So it created a moral hazard of them being wasteful. They thought, well, there's more where they came from. We don't need to be super careful. And as long as it works, and for a long time it did work, World War I, of course, is a complete rout for the Russians, and therefore it doesn't work, and it leads to the Russian Revolution. If it does work, that political class doesn't have any need to change. I would argue a similar pattern is happening in the United States, where, yeah, quote, we lost, unquote, but like it didn't really affect the U.S. political system. And then second of all, per the my criticism of autocracy, autocratic regimes routinely execute and imprison generals because they're afraid that they might overthrow them. And so in Russia's case, okay, autocracy, obvious. The United States, it's the oligarchy. It's the shadow government of financial interests, which looks a lot more like an autocratic regime than it does a republic.
Fascinating discussion yet again, Todd. Okay. I mean, I think I'm a bit closer to understanding where I am on this. I mean, I feel in my bones that I like to defend the Maverick. I don't know. There's a kind of British love of eccentricity in a way as well. But I think that I honestly think that, and I've written a article that's going to appear in a journal along these lines. I think systems are more anti-fragile and more robust when they allow disagreeable types to voice the criticisms, to point out where things are going wrong, and not to kind of shut them out, which has been the current prevailing wisdom. And what I argue in that paper is that it's across the board in foreign policy and in military matters more than anywhere else, where the guy who's pointing out various realities, let's say on Russia and Ukraine, just going to be fired, or he's going to end up finding himself sitting on Judge Knapp or something, right? Not where he should be, which is part of that advisory board, or part of that decision-making unit. Because the problem is it creates what I would call an error cascade. If you only have yes men and guys who were there because they're loyal, there's nobody there to say, hold on a second, this is a fucking stupid plan. Or what if it goes wrong? Or you just don't have the capability to do this, or whatever else. You understand what I mean? So that's one thing. And then, of course, the flip side of it is those are also likely the people going to be the people who innovate or create something new or look at the situation in a slightly different way. If they're all selected out, you're worse off at the end of it. So to that extent, I agree with your defense of meritocracy. I still feel there are other questions on this, but it's such a big topic that we're going to have to admit defeat. We're now going to really get to the bottom of it. Where can people find you, Todd?
Well, you can find me at POF Podcast on X. You can follow my YouTube channel and the Praise of Folly Podcast. Just type it into YouTube. And we'll just wrap it up in a bow. Meritocracy is a safe space for mavericks.
Fantastic. All right. Well, I'll just remind people, pick up Trivium, all the other great courses. 25% off with promo code SHORJAN. Get the books and everything. The most important of all, friends, get out. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to
pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.